I'm Christopher Lydon, asking the Pakistani writer Mohammed Hanif to put his wide-angle novelist's scope on the explosion together of fanaticism, public murder, and politics in the Punjab last week, not entirely unlike what happened in Arizona too. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Mohammed Hanif, in this one from Karachi, wrote one of the great global novels of modern Pakistan titled A Case of Exploding Mangoes, for which, Mohammed Hanif, you were compared with Salman Rushdie for magical realism and to the American Joseph Heller of Catch-22 for your comic darkness, also to the immortal Kafka for nightmare fantasy. And all of it is playing out now in the brazen murder by what looked to be his bodyguard of the governor of the Pakistani Punjab. The cause, so to speak, was Governor Taseer's defiance of an Islamist law against blasphemy. We'll have to talk about that. But the issue going forward seems to be who is willing to condemn unequivocally the use of assassination to make a point in Pakistani politics. How does it shape up at this point?
Chris, there are quite a few people who are willing to condemn it. There are some newspaper editors who've taken a clear stance. But I think what was shocking was, and nobody had expected it, and I was here in my office sort of watching it on TV as soon as the news broke. And I think what people found pretty repulsive and grotesque was that within minutes of his assassination, we didn't even know if he had died or not. We knew that he'd been shot and taken to a hospital. That there were mainstream journalists who were kind of, you know, almost saying that he was basically asking for it. And soon after that, the reporters went to the religious parties and religious scholars asking for their reactions. And I don't know that why do they do it in Pakistan, because this seems to be a new malaise that whatever problem we might have, we ring up a religious scholar or leader of a religious group to get their opinion. But since everybody assumed that since he'd been campaigning against the blasphemy laws, that it must have something to do with it. And suddenly there were all these mullahs who were not ready to condemn it. And they were kind of seemed to be speaking in one voice, which was basically that he was asking for it, that somehow just by saying that this is a man-made law, right, and it should be amended because the law has been abused over the last kind of, you know, decade or so. There are lots of people who have been wrongly accused of blasphemy. And although they haven't, they've gone through the judicial process, but at some point the mob mentality takes over and there'll always be somebody willing to kill this person who's been accused. So you've created a situation where just by accusing somebody of this thing, you basically condemn them. So that, I think, scared a lot of people, that suddenly this tragedy has happened, this brutal murder in the heart of the capital of Pakistan, in Islamabad, in broad daylight. And suddenly you have a major section of opinion in Pakistan, which is not only willing to condone it, but they were celebrating. It just seemed that they'd smelled blood as if it was some kind of victory. And since that day, they've been trying to frame the debate in a way that, did he do anything to deserve it or not? Whereas they've forgotten the fact, the basic fact, that he didn't do anything. And B, even if somebody does something, you know, which could be a crime or which could, you know, sort of. So then what should you do? Pakistan might look like a basket case from outside, but we've got courts. We've got a fairly independent, you know, sort of a higher judiciary. One may not agree with them all of the time. So why, if somebody commits a crime, you go to the police, you register a case, you go to the court and you fight that case? So I think that's what people found very frightening.
I take it there's sort of double jeopardy here. If you're charged and acquitted in the court on a blasphemy charge, you might still be knocked off by vigilantes for the profit.
I think that's the whole problem, that the issue is so emotional and sentimental, and some of these people are so sort of charged. There have been at least, I think, 30 people who were accused, acquitted, and then killed by vigilantes.
Yeah. The law, explain the law. I have read that, say you throw a salesman's business card in the trash, if his name on the card is Muhammad, the person who tosses it can be charged with disrespecting the name of the Holy Prophet.
Well, there was a case like that last month, and there have been kind of other bizarre cases like that. But the problem, you see, is that, yes, this was a law which was sort of brought in by a military dictator who was Pakistan's first original mullah, although he didn't have a beard. But what has happened since then is that, that the marginal groups, the religious groups, sectarian groups, some of these violent outfits, who otherwise would never get any support amongst the people. Nobody goes and votes for them in the elections. So what they've done is that they've used that law or issues surrounding that law to kind of gain public support for it, to become more affluent. This law has been used, like, you know, for all kinds of things, for land grabbing, for farming disputes, for the disputes between neighbors, all kinds of things. So this is a law which is kind of used to settle a score, because everybody knows that when you accuse somebody of having committed blasphemy, then it's as good as you're condemning that person.
So where Muhammad Hanif is what we think of as the sane Pakistan. Najam said he was talking to us about it. I mean, that there is a big, middle-class, educated, democratic-spirited body of Pakistanis. They may or may not be a majority, but they're a big piece of that society. And it is a free country with an open press. What are they saying? Where are they?
Well, they were... They were scared till yesterday. Every single politician, every single journalist who I saw on TV was very, very careful about what they were saying. Whatever they had to say, they made sure that, first of all, they sent this message that obviously they cannot think of committing blasphemy ever. So, first of all, people were trying to establish their credentials, that they should not be confused with somebody who might commit blasphemy. But last couple of days, I have seen that even people who were a bit scared, especially a couple of newspaper editors, they have come out in full force. People's Party, which I think is partly responsible for this atrocity, because they had set out with the intention of amending these laws. They had formed a parliamentary committee. And that was one of the reasons that Governor Taseer was speaking about it so openly, taking such a clear stand. But when these religious groups started to apply pressure on the government backtracked. And in a way, Salman Taseer was kind of left alone. In a way, he was abandoned. Our president Zardari couldn't even go to his funeral because of whatever fears, because of his security fears. The opposition leaders didn't attend his funeral, quoting again, security reasons, but my suspicion is that some of them didn't attend because there was a fatwa a day before the funeral where 400-500 mullahs got together and said that you will not attend the funeral of this guy because this guy is not a Muslim anymore. So they managed to create this kind of fear amongst the politicians, especially, and then in the media, and a section of the media actually actively supports them. They're like-minded in lots of ways. People's Party's boy president, Bilawal Zardari, has spoken yesterday from London at a ceremony. And he's come out very clearly, and he said that these people who are celebrating this murder, they are the ones who are blaspheming. And we will fight against them. But I think some of these things should have happened before the assassination, because there were clerics going around announcing head money, which is a clear crime, according to Pakistan's penal code.
Head money, putting literally a price on somebody's head.
Yes, yes, and media. And not only these private mullahs were putting bounty on his head, but there were these media organizations which were running this as genuine news, whereas I even kind of, you know, going by the Pakistani standards of news or anywhere, this is journalism 101, that you do not broadcast, you do not report these kinds of threats, which are kind of, you know, clearly outside of the frame of any law or any ethical framework that you might have devised for your news organization or for your country.
Mohammed Hanif, I wonder, is Pakistan at all aware of a kind of spooky link to the American events in Arizona, which I got to say horrify this country? But the parallel, I don't want to make it too close, but bringing, you know, heavy arms into a public place in broad daylight, and also politicians having to choose their words and monitor their websites very, very carefully under scrutiny as to just where they come down.
I think there was some chatter on the websites and people who use social networking websites in Pakistan. And obviously there were comparisons. And obviously there was talk that when you live in a time when we kind of, you know, sort of learn to live in an environment which is surrounded by this military speak, where we are living almost in a sort of state of perpetual war.
Yeah.
And when kind of your whole language changes, and when you use these military metaphors, when you're talking about completely, you know, sort of civilian issues, when you're talking about day-to-day stuff. And that obviously affects some people. But I'm not sure if the parallel can be kind of stretched too far, because as far as I know, I mean, almost everybody in the United States, including your probably Tea Party, has condemned it quite clearly. Is that the case?
Well, different degrees of clarity. I mean, Sarah Palin had to scurry and take down off her website this crosshair targeting of the district in which that Congressman Giffords worked and led. And nobody in elected public office is advocating assassination, but words being chosen very carefully, let's say that, and studied.
Yes, but I think Pakistan, it kind of, you know, it's slightly worse, because normal people are actually kind of, you know, sort of afraid for their lives. And media men I've already spoken about, and politicians, they're kind of, you know, looking ahead, and they're thinking that if they said something wrong, or if they do something wrong now, then, you know, sort of it might come back to haunt them. I mean, I live in a sort of relatively middle class neighborhood of Karachi. And this Friday, during the sermon, the mullah in the mosque, he declared one of the parliamentarians who also lives in the same area a non-Muslim. Now, when you declare somebody a non-Muslim from your pulpit, again, basically what you're doing is that you're condemning them to death. Basically, you're sending out a signal that somebody, some good Muslim, some good mujahid out there should go and take care of that person, right?
And what was the provocation?
The provocation was that the parliamentarian was also been involved in trying to amend the blasphemy law. And although she's not kind of coming out in public, rightly so, because her life is, there's a real threat to her life, but this guy goes, you know, sort of, and announces from his pulpit that this woman is a non-Muslim. And yes, there were some concerned citizens, locals, who kind of went to a police station, tried to register a sort of a complaint against this mullah, and it's been promised that he will be investigated. But the problem is that during last kind of so many years, they have occupied so much space in the public discourse, that whosoever tries to stand up and take their argument apart, which is at the best of times very flimsy, they are kind of, you know, sort of, they risk that they will be accused of, you know, sort of being either a kafir or a CIA agent or a blasphemer or a Jewish agent or an Indian agent. And these people who kind of say and do these kinds of things, I mean, for a very, very long time, nobody has kind of, you know, tried to check their march. I mean, I'll give you one example. I was at a college and I was talking to these kids. I got emotional. I mean, I shouldn't, but sometimes I do. I was just talking, I was supposed to talk to them about writing, but I just, since all of this was so fresh in my mind. So I asked them one question. I said, you live in Pakistan. Most of you, 98% of you are Muslims, right?
Right.
Now, have you in your life ever heard anybody, Muslim or non-Muslim, saying anything bad about our Prophet Muhammad? Have you ever heard it from any of your friends or relatives that somebody has said something bad about our Prophet Muhammad. I'm now 45 years old. I've lived in this country, and I may not be a very good Muslim. But I hang out with all kinds of people. I've hung out with people who are atheists, who don't believe in God. Even they won't come out and abuse our Prophet Muhammad, even in a private, secure gathering, because that's not how we are brought up. That's not how we look at our Prophet, because that culture actually does not exist in Pakistan. Now, whereas if somebody from Mars or somebody from outside was to kind of, you know, look into Pakistan today, look at its media, look and read the newspapers and see what people are talking about, that would seem to them that this country is full of blasphemers. The people have nothing else to do except kind of, you know, sit there and talk bad of their Prophet. Whereas that's completely the opposite of what the reality is on the ground. So I think the success of these small religious groups is that somehow they have made this complete non-issue, an issue that doesn't exist, has never existed, is not likely to exist in my lifetime in this country, is the central kind of issue that should be debated, that we should fight over it. So I think that's their big success.
Muhammad Hanif, the joy, the fun, the pleasure of engaging a novelist is in hearing the implied links here. I want you to stick with that question of the links between the shooting and war, between fanaticism and war, between the news, so to speak, and history and background, and between those gunshots from the assassin and, for example, the background noise of robot drones that are killing Pakistanis as well as Afghans, and the 30-year history of this story, which you've written about. We'll have to get to your own brilliant satire in Exploding Mangoes. But what's the larger crisis that the Pakistani imagination and mind and people and the poor people of Pakistan are going through here?
I think the basic kind of crisis that we are going through is that somehow a large majority of people are convinced that their faith is under attack. Now, you can ask me that how can your faith be under attack if 98% of people who live in this country are faithfuls, right? But again, as I said, that's not probably true all the time, because there are other battles that they have to fight. I mean, Pakistan is one of the most appalling places as far as social justice is concerned. Sometimes to me, it seems like a country where like a small minority of people, and they could be secular industrialists or secular middle of the road politicians or right wing, rabid, armed, religious thugs. That basically this group of people is holding like a huge majority hostage. Sometimes it seems to me that we're living under some kind of apartheid regime, which we have created. People like, you know, sort of us, middle-class people and kind of, you know, the politicians and the military, of course, is central to all of this. And we've never even begun to deal with the reasons for which this country was created, and which was quite basic, even the right wing and the left wing and the centrists would agree to that, which was that there should be some kind of economic and social justice for the Muslim minority in these parts. That's what this was supposed to be about. But yesterday I was at this big religious gathering where all the kind of hotshots of Pakistan's religious parties were there. And they were telling their people, that's what they were saying at the rally, that Pakistan was actually created to protect the honor of Prophet Muhammad. Now, I've lived here, like, you know, as I said, all my life. I've been to a school here. I've been to a government school where, like, ordinary people go to. I haven't kind of grown up in some kind of sheltered community. But I've never heard that kind of discourse ever in my life.
Wow. And who was saying it?
As I said, this was like the who is who of Pakistan's religious political elite, from Maulana Fazlur Rahman to, like, you know, sort of all the top political parties, some of them which are supposedly banned in Pakistan, and their leaders were also up there on the stage doing their stuff.
So that movement obviously has deep roots in Pakistan, but I want to ask about the other side of the roots here. If there is one thing that the Pakistani elite seems to know for sure, and one thing that almost no Americans seem to know at all, it's this idea that Pakistani politics, including the religious extremism, gets hatched, for 30 years now anyway, in Washington, in the CIA, in American universities and think tanks, in the Pentagon, and in Hollywood, in Charlie Wilson's War, for example. Everybody we talk to, you know, a variety of political stripes, but they say, well, don't you know that this was all planned in the Reagan administration? In your book, Case of Exploding Mangoes, which is a kind of takeoff, but it's driving at the truth, Bill Casey, Ronald Reagan's CIA chief, is running a covert operation against the Soviet Union from Pakistan through Afghanistan. And in your book, I'm reading, Bill Casey kept reminding everyone that he had the Ruskies by the balls in Afghanistan. Bill was always telling his old chum Ronald Reagan that it was the Wild West all over again, that the Afghans were cowboys with turbans, and that they were kicking Soviet ass as it had never been kicked before. How do we bridge this huge gap of understanding? A big anti-American Pakistani sense that, God, the Americans, you know, saddled us with this army and intelligence and war, and an American kind of childish innocence about the whole thing. Oh, you know, those towel heads just act that way.
Yes, I think the time that we live in did start with that alliance that Pakistan's army made with the United States. And they are still bedfellows. The problem is that Pakistan's army has had an enormous amount of power in the country's affairs. It practically runs the country, even now when we have an elected government. Foreign policy and all the security issues, they are completely and solely sort of handled by the army. And I think that has been the case for the last 30 years. Because what Ronald Reagan gifted us was that it taught our army, not that it wasn't kind of, you know, it didn't have those tendencies in the past, before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, before Ronald Reagan came along, it did have those tendencies. But it gave them the capacity, not just in material terms, but I think also in kind of, you know, intellectual terms. That how you can maintain and perpetuate this power. And obviously what happened was that with the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, the army got, you know, sort of very, very ambitious. If they could, that's what they believe even now, that if they can bring down a superpower, right, what is there to stop them from doing whatever it is that they want to do? And I think that mindset is very much there. It has been strengthened over the past 10 years. I think when this latest Afghan invasion happened, army made up its mind that it will go along with it, but will also make sure that America one day kind of leaves without sorting anything out, so that they can go back to where they had started from, because they've developed this really bizarre and absurd notion that Afghanistan as a neighbor will provide them some kind of strategic depth. Now, I've never understood, I've asked military men also, I've never really understood what exactly happens, because they believe that one day India will attack us, and then, you know, sort of, then what will happen? I don't know how that will work. Will the Pakistani army retreat to Afghanistan? Will the people of Pakistan move to Afghanistan? Is that where we will resist the Indians? So it doesn't make sense to anyone except the military mind. So what they've done as a result is that they've kept us mired in this regional conflict with India. And I think India is partly to blame. It doesn't help that it acts like, you know, sort of a nasty, old kind of a big bully in the neighborhood. But obviously, that way, Pakistan army can continue to do whatever it wants to do. It is not answerable to its own people. And increasingly, it seems that their friends, the Americans, they can get them to do something some of the times. But obviously, they kind of, you know, they're very good at fighting a war on both sides. They're very capable of fighting against themselves. And that's what they've been doing.
There's that graffiti line in your novel where somebody has written on the wall, "Roses are red, violets are blue. This country is cocky." But in your novel, General Zia is, of course, he is a front for Ronald Reagan in a certain way. He's also a prisoner of his own army and of his wife to a certain degree. But he studies the Quran religiously, so to speak, so as to figure out when to seize power and when to kill his enemies. And this blasphemy law, for which Governor Taseer died, was General Zia's idea in the first place, back in the 80s. So we're talking about one continuous saga, really.
Yes, and the problem is, I was just reading it today, like a memoir of somebody who was in the 60s, who was a very senior bureaucrat in the 60s. And we are told that in the 60s, Pakistan was quite secular, and these kind of religious right, it was like really a minuscule kind of irritant, and they had no power at all. Mm. But they were about to print these new currency notes. So they're sitting in all these kind of ministers and bureaucrats, they're sitting in a monitor kind of going through various designs of these currency notes. And quite a few of them said, oh, well, we've got like a picture of Jinnah on this, and mullahs might object to it.
He was the semi-secular founder, the Nehru of Pakistan.
The Nehru of Pakistan. So these bureaucrats were there kind of, you know, trying to second guess that what these religious fanatics might do. And we had very few of them, and they had no power at that time. But even at that time, they were scared of them. Mm. But finally, somebody overruled. The currency notes were printed with the picture. Nothing happened. Nobody objected. A couple of people kind of, you know, tried to raise a noise, but nobody listened to them. So General Zia died in 1988, right?
Yes.
After that, we've had at least 5 politically elected governments. And all the parties who came to power, they never campaigned on any of these issues. The blasphemy law was never mentioned. None of the other Islamic laws or Islamic injunctions that we keep debating about. No. People voted for them on exactly the same kind of issues that people, I'm sure, in the United States vote for, which is cheap electricity, cheap fuel, promises of cheap fuel, you know, sort of power, education, those kinds of issues. Nobody, when they go to ask votes, they don't say that we'll protect the honor of Prophet Muhammad, because everybody knows that the honor of Prophet Muhammad in Pakistan is perfectly fine. It's not in danger. So none of these political governments did anything to change or reverse or at least to amend these laws. Even General Musharraf, who was a very powerful military dictator, and he had his own kind of hand-picked political setup, and he used to make all the right noises about kind of moving Pakistan away from these religious nuts. But even he didn't do anything. He couldn't do anything. So I think what Pakistani state has done over the decades is that they've always, always, always overestimated their power. And I think that's why we've ended up in the situation that we are, that they were not as powerful. And I still believe that even today, they're not as powerful. But somehow, they managed to create an atmosphere. They have powerful backers in the army that somehow they hijack the whole discourse. And we never get to kind of, you know, doing things which, as I said, were why Pakistan came into existence in the first place.
Mohammed Hanif, how does the AFPAC war ongoing affect the day-to-day outlook of Pakistanis?
Well, I think it has sort of radicalized a section of the society which probably wouldn't have been radicalized if we didn't have this war. It had made a lot of people cynical and anti-American. Because what is happening is that you have to see, and I think this is probably the first time in the history of the world, that a friendly country, a so-called friendly country, United States, is using robots to kill the citizens of its partner in war. Now, that doesn't, whatever logic you might apply on it, it doesn't come out nice. It's never, ever, ever going to sound good to anyone.
Mm.
There's an Urdu saying, and I'm sure there's an equivalent in English as well, that when your neighbor's house is on fire, the chances are that that fire will get to you as well.
Mm.
And if you, as a nation, as a country, have been stoking that fire for 30 years, yes, Soviets were responsible, yes, United States is responsible, but Pakistan is, you know, sort of an independent country. It makes, to a certain extent, its own decisions, or the military does. So if you've had this attitude towards your neighbor, that I will fight all my dirty fights in this backyard, that you never ever consider Afghans as human beings, mm-hmm. you only speak of them like, you know, in terms of military terms, right? Either they're targets, or either they're kind of, you know, allies, or either, you know, they're collateral damage. So nobody cares about them. Americans don't, Pakistanis don't. So I believe that having that attitude has obviously meant that Pakistan is going the same route. Because these jihadi groups who were basically supposed to, initially supposed to fight in Afghanistan and then fight in Kashmir and then, I don't know, go and liberate, I don't know, Sweden or whatever other country that you might think of. But they have finally, for the last 10, 12 years, they've finally turned their guns on Pakistanis, sometimes in Pakistani establishment. And this is not just happening in a debating room. This is happening in an environment where you've got lots of groups who are very well armed, who are very well trained. And sometimes we tend to dismiss them here as a mad bunch, as nutters. Yeah. Sometimes people sit and say that, what is it that they want?
Mm.
Well, they want to, basically, they want to take over Pakistan. Somebody said that if you were an intelligent Islamic militant, right? Mm. And you had a choice either to take over Afghanistan or Pakistan, what would you do? You would take over Pakistan, obviously.
For sure.
Because it's a semi-functioning state. I mean, what are you going to get in Afghanistan except some NGO workers or I don't know.
Mountains.
Yeah, mountains, yeah.
Let me ask, this is a stretch, but from an American standpoint, it strikes me as curious that the AFPAC policy seems to consume our own top players, like General McChrystal, who shot his mouth off and got fired, and then Richard Holbrook, whose heart blew up, a man who'd been through everything. But there's something about this policy that doesn't agree with people's sanity. I mean, General McChrystal just forgot the chain of command.
He's probably hung out too many times with Pakistani generals. I think that they have that effect on people. I mean, Pakistan's chief of army staff has kind of, you know, speaks whenever he wants to, and he gets a 3-year extension. Well, you know,
yeah.
There you go. On a serious note, somebody was just talking to me the other day. We were talking about the current situation, and I don't know why. He wasn't even a journalist or a kind of, you know, a political type. He was just like, you know, an ordinary trader, an old friend of mine. And he said, what is missing between this Pakistan and American relationship? So what do you think is missing?
Knowledge, I would say. Openness, respect, visits.
Yeah, he was kind of more basic than that. He said the people.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
This relationship, that it exists between the Pakistan's army and, you know, some kind of establishment in the United States that we don't really know much about. How does it work? So basically, there's a country of 180 million people, and America over the past 30 years has dealt, you know, sort of with an armed ruling elite.
Hmm.
Which has its own kind of, you know, agenda, its own designs, which history has proved is always, almost always, not the agenda of the people. Hmm. This is not what people of Pakistan want, what the military wants. One good example of that is that you have a Pakistan army and United States army, kind of, you know, the best of allies, And then how come there is such an upsurge of anti-Americanism in Pakistan?
Yeah.
Yes, there's like one basic reason that you had George Bush and you know, America is considered an evil empire, like most of the world. So Pakistan is part of that. But why would you have the situation? Pakistan is the closest kind of, you know, Pakistan's military is at least the closest ally of the United States. And people of Pakistan can't stand the American, what they perceive as American influence in Pakistan's affairs, because it has never been actually for the good of the people.
Who in Pakistan believes in pursuing the war in Afghanistan, which is also, as you say, a war in Pakistan?
I think it has gone on for so long that even people who believed in it don't believe in it anymore, because they don't think, they don't believe that that the parties that are fighting there, Americans especially, and similarly, you know, sort of the Al-Qaeda and its remnants, that they don't really believe that that they're doing what they're saying. I mean, nobody really believe Pakistan's army that's what it's doing in its tribal areas, right? Pakistan's tribal areas were quite peaceful before this war started, actually. I'll tell you a personal story. I have a colleague who used to live in Vana, which is like the headquarter of South Waziristan. He used to run a private school there where girls could go. And this was only kind of, you know, 2001, 2002. So people there in the tribal areas, which is the, you know, as you call the Wild West or whatever you want to call it, it was exactly the kind of place where people were trying to do exactly the kind of things which people would do in a small American town or wherever, which is basically get your girls educated, you know, because the world is changing. So that's where it was headed. And now that friend of mine, school has obviously been destroyed a long time ago. And many other schools have been destroyed in Pakistan, girls' schools, which are, to me, are like the biggest casualty of this war. Because do you realize how long does it take to build a school?
Yeah.
How many kind of people have to throw in their weight? They have to campaign. They have to kind of, you know, wheel and deal with the government. Or if they're building a private school, what kind of resources go into that? Now you're basically kind of, you know, just taking that opportunity away. I thought, anybody would have thought, that that was the real hope in those areas.
Yeah. Najam Sethi, the journalist, who I take to be the patriotic free spirit of Pakistan, he told us that Pakistan could live perfectly happily with a Taliban government in Kabul. Who agrees with him?
I think Pakistan's army does.
Really?
Lots of Pakistan's right-wing politicians, they would do it. And if it helped calm down things in Pakistan, then I think majority of Pakistanis would be happy with that. They were happy with Taliban when they were there in the first place. In fact, Pakistan was one of the two countries. And sometimes some of these military types, they take credit. They say that we created the Taliban. So they will be completely happy. But as I said, when people say that, and I respect Najam Sethi's opinion, and he is a very brave and forthright journalist. But when people say that the Pakistanis could live with the Taliban government in Afghanistan, the question that I ask them is usually, do you think you can live with the Taliban government in Pakistan? Now, that's where they're not too sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where kind of, you know, they think, as I said, you know, they think that their neighbor's house can be on fire, but somehow we can kind of live happily ever after. Now, my own kind of, you know, reading of this, our recent history is that that's not likely to happen.
Which the Taliban Pakistan?
Yes, Taliban Pakistan. That if we think that we can hand over Afghanistan to a friendly sort of Taliban government where they can chop off people's hands and where they can, you know, sort of imprison the all their women population and we will be fine. I don't think that's going to happen.
What would you do about the Taliban in Afghanistan?
God, I don't know. I'm not big on solutions. I don't know. I'll I've kind of, you know, seen various kind of proposals that people keep giving, and I don't feel optimistic about any of them. I do think that a genuine ceasefire is a start. I think negotiations is the only way. I think it might help to calm down things if America disengages and that space, that security space is occupied by some other kind of, you know, sort of force which is looked upon as more neutral and more friendly by the locals, as well as by Pakistanis, as well as by Indians or whosoever is kind of, you know, trying to lay claim to Afghanistan. In very vague terms, I think that could be a start. But at the moment, I think everybody is kind of, you know, everybody's waiting. Pakistan army thinks that that it has been proven right, that it knew that Americans will come. They will never achieve what they want to achieve, right? And then one day they will go back. And Pakistan somehow will be able to install a friendly government in Afghanistan. Now, that they might achieve that. That government might be friendly to Pakistan. But will that government be friendly to Afghan people?
Interesting. I want to ask you a literary question. What is it about Pakistan which is so dangerous a place and state of mind in the whole world? What is it about Pakistan that seems also to invite broad satire? I'm thinking of your own Exploding Mangoes, but also, you know, Salman Rushdie's Shame, covering some of the same areas. And that movie, the Tom Hanks movie, Charlie Wilson's War. I mean, this country is a sort of setup for...
That was an American movie, so that's American sense of humor, not Pakistan.
Yeah, but it's a setup for a kind of grim humor, and people sort of forget that the story underlying it is true.
I can talk about myself. I grew up in a village first, and then I moved to a small city in Punjab. And the traditional form of entertainment there was that you'll stand at a street corner and people would just make jokes about the current affairs, about your political leaders, about the village elder, about the mullah in the mosque. Anybody who kind of carried or thought that he carried any kind of authority. It was part of our culture, part of at least Punjabi culture, that you have to make fun of that person. And it was quite accepted in the culture. Even people who were being made fun of kind of accepted it, that if you, that was something that came with power, that came with authority, that people will make fun of you. So I used to hang out with these bunch of people who were kind of, you know, professional joke tellers. There's a sort of set of families or tribes in Punjab. Whose sole job is that they kind of go around telling jokes, and they turn up at weddings and engagements and family gatherings, and that's what they do. They kind of, you know, will make fun of the family's elder. So I grew up with them. So for me, kind of the first knowledge of the world or the first kind of insight into how the world is run, how a country is run, how a city is run, how a family kind of works together. That I got from them.
From the comedy club.
From the comedy clubs. I mean, they were basically what your kind of stand-up comics would do. But it was much more informal because they would just stand at a street corner, hang out with, you know, sort of the other boys or other people and make those jokes. And now I was reading somewhere and suddenly clicked to me that I just don't have that in me to be a stand-up comic. I'm not sharp-witted when I'm kind of, you know, sort of talking to a bunch of people or when I'm talking to a friend. So I'm more of what somebody called a sit-down comic. That I can sit down, struggle with myself and maybe compose a joke or come up with a character which kind of, you know, sort of might reflect some of those absurdities. So that's me. And I think even now, in fact, now that you mention it, Pakistan has like lots and lots of TV news channels now. And for the last few years, people have been sick of these pundits, like, you know, sort of who do basically what, you know, sort of what TV talk show hosts do all over the world, that they kind of sit there with a bunch of talking heads and they... And suddenly I've seen that every single channel has got a satirical show, like, you know, a political satire show. And those are the shows which are doing really, really, really well. Because sometimes what happens is that, things are so bad, things can be so bad, that nobody actually wants any more analysis. Nobody actually wants any more pundits like telling them the future, because they basically know that it's all kind of, you know, downhill. So we might as well sit here and laugh at ourselves. And I think that that might be one explanation.
You are a master of sit-down comedy. I mean, I'm thinking of so many episodes in Exploding Mangoes. But for example, Osama bin Laden himself, OBL, turns up at an American embassy party in the 80s in that Reagan-Zia era when we're fighting the Soviets through Pakistan and Afghanistan. And there he is, Osama bin Laden with the beard, handing out business cards for his construction company.
It kind of started, it is a joke, and started as a joke, because I just thought that every novel should have like a big party scene. So I wanted to throw a party for my characters. And then I kind of started making, when you have a party, you have to make a guest list. So I was kind of making an imaginary guest list that who might have been around that time, who might have come to this party. And suddenly I thought, oh, well, you know, so if he was around somewhere in Peshawar or somewhere, so it's like only an hour's drive from there. So he could be there. It was only that after I had written that brief scene and that I realized that maybe, I mean, there is some probably truth in it, because what happens in that scene is that he kind of, you know, gets almost ignored. Nobody kind of, you know, really, he's not the center of the party. He's just kind of drifting around on the edges. So it just occurred to me that maybe that's what I was trying to hint at. And I wasn't aware of it when I was writing it then. Mm. Then maybe he's kind of, you know, like one of those attention seekers. We live in this celebrity culture where, like, you know, sort of there are people kind of, you know, leak their sex videos themselves to to become a sensation. And that's what, you know, sort of he used to do when he came into the business after 2001. That there'll be these like videotapes and these audio messages and all that kind of stuff. So it does seem to me that, yes, there's a bit of kind of, you know, attention seeking going on there.
I'm just wondering, is it a promising sign that Pakistan, at the very center of a world crisis, is also producing nowadays this case of exploding writers? I mean, so much literary talent coming out of Pakistan now and being read in the States, in Europe, especially England.
I don't know if it's a good sign or if it's a bad sign. Because it doesn't change anything, really. I mean, it might kind of, you know, entertain some people. It might, some people might think that they've read this book about Pakistan, so now they have an insight into the country. But I don't really think, as far as the country is concerned, I don't really think it makes any difference this way or that way. We have a country where kind of a majority is illiterate. It's probably one of the very few countries in the world where illiteracy is actually rising. Most people who can read or write cannot read in English. So I do try and do kind of, you know, stuff in Urdu as well. I do a lot of journalism in Urdu. Then you have even people who can read in English and can, you know, sort of afford to buy these books. They'd rather go to a fashion show or a ball or you know, sort of go holiday in Dubai. But having said all of that, sometimes I go to these colleges and universities, like just to talk to kids. Sometimes they ask me to just come and have a chat with the kids. And when I see these kind of, you know, 19, 20 years old, 21 years old, then I do feel kind of, despite myself, I feel some kind of optimism. Because there seems to be a genuine kind of desire for change. I was telling you that just yesterday, I was at this College Institute of Business Administration, it's called. It's Karachi's kind of, you know, sort of big business school. And they just called me in. So I was just talking to these 250 people. And they were all kind of very intelligent and very keen. And they'd read my book with a lot of interest. And they asked, like, you know, sort of really searching questions. And then a couple of them, after the talk, when I was having tea, they came and kind of accosted me. And they were so mad about this whole Governor Taseer and this whole blasphemy issue. And they were basically rightly criticizing me. That's all very well to kind of, you know, write your pieces in Guardian and for the BBC. But why don't you write more in Urdu? Because if you, and they could read English, but they knew that till the time you kind of write in your own people's language, till the time you get to them, nothing is going to change. So I think for like 19, 20 years old to kind of recognize that and to be able to articulate that with that kind of force, that I find quite impressive.
Wow, I can understand why. And I was going to ask you, I mean, how do you and the other novelists define your own assignment now in reporting not only to the world, but in being a yeast in your own community? Maybe that's the answer.
I think I have a sort of a slight advantage in the sense that I can write, and I do write in Urdu and sort of one or two other languages, Pakistani languages as well, which some of our other writers who write in English don't. So I feel that I don't have an excuse. I really just can't say that, yes, I have to. I am a novelist. That's my primary job. But I am a citizen as well. And by being a citizen and having been a journalist for such a long time and having access to all these kind of news outlets, I do feel responsible that I should, you know, do my bit. I'm never sure and that it will change anything or it will affect anything. But I do think that I should do what I can.
I know you will, Mohammed Hanif. Let me just say, it's a privilege to hear you speak. And it's a special privilege always, I think, to hear novelists, because I think they tell us essential truths more deeply, and they tell them before anybody else will put their finger on them. You've said an awful lot to us this morning, and I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you. It was lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.